From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine crisis. The IRC says it's a critical time in South Sudan. More economic growth in Indian China than previously thought. Plus two greats of the pop music world and what they're up to. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukraine has restored military conscription just hours after Russia's foreign minister called for talks between Kiev and pro-Russian separatists in southeastern Ukraine. Ukraine's acting president, Oleksandr Turchynov, signed a decree Thursday on improving the country's defense capabilities, citing what it describes as the further aggravation of the socio-political situation in eastern and southern Ukraine, as well as blatant aggression by illegal armed pro-Russian groups. The decree reinstates the draft for non-exempt Ukrainian men between the ages of 18 and 25. The move comes a day after Mr. Chernov said that his government was helpless to quell the growing pro-Russian separatist movement in two eastern regions and could not control its own troops. Earlier on Thursday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow thinks a dialogue could be established between Ukraine's government and its opponents. Meantime, Ukrainian officials are accusing separatists in eastern Ukraine of using hostages as human shields to prevent the military from taking action against them. But some observers in Kiev disagree. They say the hostages, including some observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, are being held to swap for detained pro-Russian activists. VOA's Brian Patton has more from Kiev.
In the southeast Ukrainian city of Slovansk, pro-Russian militants have detained a number of OSCE observers, journalists, and local officials. Ukrainian authorities say they have been taken hostage to deter the military from attacking. But Ukrainian political analyst Sergei Slobodchuk disagrees.
I don't think that they had a far-reaching plan to use them as human shields. They did not take enough hostages to protect them if the military takes action.
Slobodchuk says the separatists do not fear retaliation from the military or police in the region because neither group is strong enough, nor do these security forces want to get involved in what they see as a political power struggle. Igor Damon, the police spokesman for the city of Donetsk, says authorities are using dialogue rather than force to deal with the protesters who have taken over government buildings.
We are negotiating with them, and the main goal for us is to prevent bloodshed. Everybody should understand that if either side takes up arms, this can grow into a war against brothers.
Separatists in Slovansk say they want to exchange their prisoners for pro-Russian activists who were arrested in Kiev. Bogdan Ovcharuk with the human rights group Amnesty International says his organization is calling for a full investigation into these detentions.
And from the reports for what we've seen, that these separatist groups are using people as a bargaining chip is appalling, it's unlawful, and this should be tackled urgently.
Amnesty International says both pro-Kiev and pro-Russian groups have been involved in illegally detaining people, and there seems to be no national authority to be able to stop either side. Brian Patton, VOA News, Kiev.
Also in the news, Syrian opposition activists say government aircraft struck a busy market in the rebel-controlled district of Aleppo, killing at least 33. Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Thursday's attack occurred in the Hillock area. The attack comes a day after a strike on an Aleppo school left 18 dead, many of them children. Aleppo's been divided between government forces and rebels, with forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad carrying out frequent airstrikes and dropping crude barrel bombs in rebel-held areas. Iraqi election officials are counting ballots. They did so on Thursday after the country's first general election since the U.S. troops withdrew in 2011. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said the high level of participation was a slap in the face to terrorism and those who wanted to disrupt the poll. He said he considers the voter turnout in the parliamentary elections to be a slap in the face, but he said people don't want the country to succeed. Prime Minister expressed confidence that his party would take the lead and call on others to join him in forming a ruling coalition. Final results from the election are not expected for at least 2 weeks now. Election officials say about 60% of the country's 22 million eligible voters took part in Wednesday's vote. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is warning of the risk of genocide in South Sudan if 4 months of deadly fighting there is not stopped. VOA's Scott Stearns reporting now from Ethiopia, where Mr. Kerry on Thursday discussed the violence with regional foreign ministers and African Union officials.
Secretary Kerry says those responsible for what he calls unspeakable violence in South Sudan must be brought to justice to prevent the conflict from deteriorating further.
There are very disturbing leading indicators of the kind of ethnic, tribal, targeted, nationalistic killings taking place that raise serious questions, and were they to continue in the way that they have been going, could really present a very serious challenge to the international community with respect to the question of genocide.
Kerry says he's working with regional leaders to avoid that by moving to put people on the ground who can begin to make a difference, separating people and providing security. He met here in Addis Ababa with foreign ministers from Ethiopia, Kenya, and Uganda, who he says all agree on the need for African troops under a United Nations mandate. He also pushed them to join U.S. moves toward a travel ban and assets freeze on those responsible for the violence, but said Washington is absolutely prepared to move on its own.
We may well move on our own, but each of the foreign ministers today accepted the responsibility for also doing sanctions.
Kerry says some of the violence is the responsibility of individual generals with their own agenda, but the place to start is the place where it started, and that's with South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar. The most serious fighting began in late December, soon after the Kiir government accused Machar of trying to seize power. While a senior State Department official says Washington does not buy into the narrative of a coup attempt, Kerry says there is a clear distinction between the men, whose personal anger is fueling this violence.
The current president of South Sudan is the elected constitutional president of a country. And Mr. Machar is a rebel who is trying to unconstitutionally take power by force. And there is a clear distinction. There is no equivalency between the two.
Kerry says Machar needs to think clearly about that, particularly in the wake of allegations that ethnic Nuer rebels killed hundreds of civilians in the town of Bentiu last month. A UN report says the rebels separated individuals of certain nationalities and ethnic groups and escorted them to safety while the others were killed. A rebel spokesman has denied that allegation. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Hundreds of women and girls were abducted last month in Nigeria, allegedly by Boko Haram. The government's been trying to grapple with the activists of the Islamist terrorist group. In light of the story, VOA's Susan Yaki spoke with Max Abrams of Northeastern University and the Council on Foreign Relations, who just finished a study on militant kidnappings. She asked, under what conditions are hostage takers more likely to achieve their demands?
Yes, this is a question that I focus on extensively in my research. Generally, I look at which tactics are best from the vantage of the perpetrators. And by perpetrators, I usually mean militant groups. So in the case of hostage taking, militant groups tend to take the hostages in order to achieve what's sometimes called redemptive demands. The nature of their demands is often pertains to the building up of their organization. So they may ask for financial demands. Those are the most common. They may ask for the release of prisoners held by the government. They may ask for safe passage into another location, into another country. In the case of Boko Haram, it's not entirely clear why they took the hostages, but presumably to help their organization in a similar way. And I've just completed a statistical study with my co-author, Matthew Gottfried, over at UCLA, where we look at the determinants of hostage-taking success. That is, the likelihood that the hostage-takers will achieve at least one of their demands for the organization. And we actually have good news. What we find is that the better the hostage-takers treat the hostages, the more likely the government is to subsequently bargain with the hostage-takers. In particular, we look at the effects of harming the hostages versus releasing them unharmed. And what we find is that governments are significantly and substantially less likely to trade with the hostage-takers after they've physically harmed one of the hostages. And so the implications of this study are really clear for Boko Haram, and that is that Boko Haram is more likely to achieve its demands if it releases unscathed the 273 women in their custody.
Does the treatment of the hostages also contribute to the government's decision whether or not to invade, to attack, and violently end the hostage situation?
In our study, we didn't test that directly. But in other studies of mine, yes, what I have found is that when militant groups attack non-combatants, and this would clearly be a case of that, because the girls were, you know, going to school, and certainly once they were taken as hostages, you know, they were in a position to resist. And what I find is that when civilians are harmed by non-state actors, particularly militant groups, governments tend to go on the offensive. They tend to dig in their political heels, and they tend to try to violently oppose the perpetrators. And so for that reason as well, I would strongly urge Boko Haram to release the hostages. They're much unharmed. Doing so would increase the odds that they would achieve their demands and lower the odds that the government will, you know, violently oppose the perpetrators.
Max Abrams, a professor at Northeastern University and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was speaking with my colleague Susan Yockey.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Leader of the political wing of the Irish Republican Army has been arrested in connection with the murder 42 years ago during the region's conflict. VOA's Al Pessin reporting now from London.
The arrest of Gerry Adams followed several hours of police questioning Wednesday. Police had called him in to talk about the murder of widowed mother of 10, Jean McConville, in 1972, when Northern Ireland was embroiled in violence. The arrest is apparently linked to interviews with former Irish Republican Army fighters for a history project at Boston University in the United States. The interviews were to have been kept secret until all the interviewees died. But last year, a U.S. court ordered the university to hand the tapes over to the police in Northern Ireland. One of the interviewees was arrested in March for alleged involvement in the killing. At least one of the interviews implicates Adams. The leader of Sinn Féin, the Irish Republican Army's political wing, Adams has always denied involvement in the incident. Over the last two decades, he has become a key figure in the region's reconciliation efforts. In a statement Thursday, the 65-year-old politician said he is innocent of any part in the abduction, killing, or burial of Mrs. McConville, which he called wrong and a grievous injustice. 3 years ago, he made this statement about the period called the Troubles.
I regret very much that anyone was killed as a result of conflict in our country. And there's a lot of work to be done by all of us as part of a healing process in the time ahead.
During the Troubles, Republicans, mostly Catholics, wanted the British territory to reunite with the rest of Ireland. Unionists, mostly Protestants, wanted it to remain part of Britain. Members of the radical Irish Republican Army carried out a violent campaign to try to force Britain to withdraw from Northern Ireland. In 1972, its leaders suspected 37-year-old Jean McConville of informing the British Army about its activities. A gang abducted her from her home in front of her children, and she was never seen again. Nearly 30 years later, as part of reconciliation efforts, the IRA revealed the location of her grave at a beach 80 kilometers from her home. She had been shot in the back of the head. The Northern Ireland Peace Accord Gerry Adams helped finalize in 1998 has largely been successful, but there are still occasional flare-ups of violence. The most recent was just over a year ago in a dispute over removing the British flag from the city government building in the region's capital, Belfast. Gerry Adams' arrest comes in the midst of campaigning for local and European Parliament elections. He questioned the timing of the arrest, and his party called it politically motivated, a charge the British Prime Minister's office denied. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
A new study is suggesting the economies of India and China have grown more than previously thought, leading some analysts to predict that China could surpass the United States as the world's biggest economy by the end of the year. This is earlier than many experts had predicted, and the same study shows India overtaking Japan as the world's third largest economy. Those results come from a different economic measurement than the widely used GDP figures. The so-called PPP is supposed to better account for the differences in the cost of living in different nations. VOA's Jim Randall explains.
The International Comparison Program, a part of the United Nations, took a new look at many aspects of major economies, including their relative sizes, using a method called Purchasing Power Parity, or PPP. Professor Kamel Malahi of the University of Warwick in Britain says PPP gives a good look at the relative cost of goods in different nations and how much it costs to buy things that ordinary people need.
It just captures how far does a dollar go in terms of buying goods and services in different countries. You take a basket of goods, like we all buy, including milk, butter, sugar, going to the movie, price of haircut, in different countries, and they look at the cost of that in different countries.
Scholars then work out what amounts to a hypothetical exchange rate and use that to compare economies. On the other hand, the gross domestic product, or GDP, measures all the goods and services produced in a nation. It uses market-based exchange rates, the rates that travelers or exporters would get at a bank, to compare one economy to another. But those rates can be affected by many factors. Bankrate.com chief financial analyst Greg McBride says PPP eliminates some of those distortions, but calls PPP more of an estimate than a precise measurement.
So there's a huge margin of error there that I think can really kind of throw the whole validity of the whole thing into question.
World Bank figures from 2012 show China's GDP was just over $8 trillion, while the U.S. GDP was more than $16 trillion. But Professor Malahi says the GDP measurement has problems.
I think with traditional GDP, people always said it underestimates the size of economies, developing countries and some of the emerging economies, because the cost of living is cheaper and lower there.
University of New Haven economics professor Robert Reynish says that PPP is not more or less accurate than the GDP, just a different lens for looking at economic activity.
You get a different picture.
However you measure, China and India have been growing faster than developed economies like the United States for some time. In fact, the most recent report shows the U.S. economy expanding at a weak 0.1% rate in the first 3 months of this year. Jim Randall, VOA News, Washington.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
And from the world of music, British rock star Paul McCartney's first concert in Ecuador was at its highest to date. highest in the sense that the 71-year-old former Beatle performed in Quito at an altitude of 2,850 meters. The concert included the song All You Need Is Love, which Ecuador is currently using in a global tourism campaign. Said, we love you, Quito and Ecuador. It didn't sound too bad for 71 years old. A South American leg of McCartney's Out There tour has included performances in Uruguay, Chile, Peru, and Costa Rica. McCartney performed for nearly 3 hours in Quito earlier this week. He's performed in past high altitudes, such as Bogota, Colombia, and Mexico City. Former pop singer and Tucson, Arizona native Linda Ronstadt has put her house up for sale. It was built back in 1929 in the famed Colonial Solana neighborhood of Tucson, asking price $1.6 million. Well, Ronstadt, who now has Parkinson's disease, was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame just 3 weeks ago. She now lives in San Francisco and is retired from singing. When she wrote her memoir titled Simple Dreams not long ago, she was asked, why that title for the book?
Well, the dream was fairly simple. I wanted to sing. I, when I was a little girl, I didn't want to be famous. I didn't want to be a star. I didn't think of any of that stuff. I just wanted to sing. I loved to sing. And I wanted to have a job singing so I didn't have to have a job doing something else and I could spend all my time singing. Because in order to get good, you really have to spend 6 or 8 hours a day doing it. I mean, honestly, if you're a cello player or a violin player or a singer, you have to spend hours and hours and hours and hours day after day, year after year.
And at the height of her career, Ronstadt sang a duet with another famous American entertainer, Aaron Neville. Here they are singing All My Life. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the Internet at voanews.com, and we hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Keith Holmes, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday. Now a little bit more of Linda Ronstadt and Aaron Neville.
This is Today in History. On May 2nd, 1670, the Hudson Bay Company was chartered to oversee trade throughout much of British-controlled territory in North America. The company's traders and trappers were responsible for much of the early exploration on the North American continent. On this day in 1860, Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, was born in Budapest. Herzl championed the dream of a permanent home for the Jewish people. He died in 1904, 45 years before his dream was realized. On this day in 1933, a Scottish newspaper, the Inverness Courier, reported the account of a local couple that claimed to have seen an enormous animal rolling and plunging in the waters of Loch Ness. The newspaper's editor took the liberty of calling the beast a monster, and when the story was picked up by the London newspapers, the modern legend of the Loch Ness Monster was born. In 1994, South African President F.W. de Klerk conceded victory to Nelson Mandela and his African National Congress in their overwhelming victory in the country's first all-race election. Mandela was inaugurated May 10th as the head of a national unity government. American singer Leslie Gore was born on this day in 1946. One of the most popular pop singers of the 1960s, Gore's first hit was recorded at the tender age of 16. The record's producer was Quincy Jones. Leslie's brother, Michael Gore, is an Oscar-winning composer. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Why was he holding her hand when he's supposed to be mine? It's my
part. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S.-South Korea alliance is special. It was forged on the battlefield and has been fortified by the common values and mutual respect of both peoples. Indeed, the United States military efforts on behalf of South Korea have contributed to the modern economic miracle that South Korea has become. This country has risen from occupation and ruin and become one of the most vibrant and open democracies in the world, President Barack Obama said on his recent visit to South Korea. None of this was an accident. Freedom and democracy must be fought for, according to President Obama. The 38th parallel now exists as much as a contrast between worlds as it does a border between South Korea and North Korea, between a society that's open and one that is closed, between a democracy that is growing and a pariah state that prioritizes its nuclear weapons program over the well-being of its own people. The stark contrast between North and South Korea is a result of the divergent choices North Korea and South Korea have made. North Korea has chosen to develop its nuclear and ballistic missile programs in violation of multiple UN Security Council resolutions. I want to be clear, said President Obama. The commitment that the United States of America has made to the security of the Republic of Korea only grows stronger in the face of aggression. North Korea's continued pursuit of nuclear weapons is a path that leads only to more isolation. It's not a sign of strength. Indeed, strength is allowing people to participate in an open democracy and choose their own leaders and their own destiny. Real strength is allowing a vibrant society to flourish by encouraging people to think, pray, and speak their minds as they please, even if it is against their leaders. Real strength is allowing the existence of free and open markets, such as in South Korea, that have built thriving middle classes. The leaders of North Korea have a choice. They can continue down the road of isolation, or they can join the rest of the international community. If they choose this path, the United States and its allies will help them build that future. But if they do not, the United States stands ready to defend itself and its allies. The United States will continue to support the path that the leaders and the people of South Korea have chosen to take, the path of democracy, freedom, and open markets. And our alliance with South Korea will grow stronger as a result.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.